We shall continue then with part two of our studies. And if Britain is Tarshish, then what are the implications?
Come straight to the point. I think we have to recognise how little, in a way, the Bible tells us explicitly about Britain, about its allies. We have to realise that we are dealing with a very dynamic situation. We're not talking about a latter-day metals trader, but we're talking about a force in the world. And I put in with some trepidation the word ethnic. Remember how the Lord tells us we can expect kingdom to be fighting kingdom and ethnos to be fighting ethnos. And we're certainly seeing a lot of ethnic division of the world independent of national boundaries, Yugoslavia perhaps being one of the best examples, and Russia being another one which will become more obvious the nearer we get to Christ's return. So we may be talking, therefore, about an English-speaking people. We're talking about this power having a major role to play at Armageddon, and as I hope to show you, that being so, it doesn't have any part of Europe, and will become non-aligned to Europe. Let us remind ourselves, brothers, this is something very, very serious. We're not in the prediction business. We are watchers, as Habakkuk would tell us. But we are watching, unlike our friends around, because we have the more sure word of prophecy, whereunto we do well to take heed. What's the point of watching, I think Brother Thomas said, or Brother Roberts, if you do not have a light to watch with? Well, we have the word of prophecy that is a light that shineth in a dark place until the day dawn and the day star rise in your heart. And so then, what we have to remember all the time is we're not in the prediction business. Of course we know what will happen in the end. Of course we know that Christ will return to this earth and set up his kingdom here on this earth. We know we have to face resurrection and judgment. We know those things, it's just as well we do. But when it comes to the nations around us, we need to exercise great care. And I thought Brother Cyril Tennant offered some very sound and very wise words in the Christadelphian just about a year ago, when he said that what worried him was the great danger which arises from seeking to interpret prophecy by current events, rather than being so familiar with Bible teaching that we're able to scan current events for their fulfillment. For example, the changing face of world politics has led to various interpretations of the King of the North, Turkey, Russia, Germany. What is seriously disconcerting is not so much a wrong anticipation of the fulfillment of prophecy, but the accompanying abuse of Scripture in an attempt to make it fit exciting current events. What he's saying is, what we're tending to do, perhaps, is to look at our television sets, look at our newspapers, and say, well, that's convincingly happening. Well, perhaps our old Christadelphian ideas about prophecy are wrong, and maybe, in the weight of all this evidence, like the end of Russia, we ought to change our mind about it, withdraw all those pamphlets up there that spell out the old Christadelphian view. Well, I have a challenge, brothers and sisters. What kind of Bible Christian would proclaim the hope of Israel when the Middle East looked like that? What kind of Bible student would it be who would sally forth even unto the ball ring and say, I believe that the time is coming when the Ottoman Empire, the world's greatest empire that then existed, been in existence 500 years, will be washed away, and that we will have an independent state of Israel, and that the independent state of Israel would ultimately be attacked by a power out of the north. That power in the north has just been crushed in the Crimean War. What kind of person would it do that sort of thing? And on what basis would you preach the hope of Israel 100 and 150 years ago? It could only be on the basis of prophecy. It could only be because there was no doubt in the minds of our pioneer brothers and sisters as to what the Bible had in store for us. And while we're talking about that, let me offer another thought. What kind of Bible Christian was it that foresaw an Arab-Russo alliance when the Arab nations didn't even exist? What kind of Bible student was it who said, we're looking for the kingdom of God, that we'll be surrounded by aggressive nations. You read Elpis Israel, what do you find? You find, lo and behold, there, Brother Thomas is saying, in 1848, when Russia was nobody, when the Arab nations as we now know them didn't exist, the time is coming when there would be that grand alliance out of the north who would come down onto Israel. So whether Cyril Tennant knew it or not, I don't know, but one of our early brethren wrote thus. The reader should take no reliance upon newspaper speculations. Their scribes know not what God has revealed. Consequently, their reasonings are vain and are sure to take a wrong direction. As records of facts, the journals are invaluable. But if a person permit his opinions to be formed by views in leading articles, he will be continually misled. It is the Bible that is the enlightenment. If men would not be carried about by every wind that blows, let them study this. And so, you see, this subject, remember, you've got to get rid of Britain if you want to embrace new ideas about what will happen in the last days. And so what you do is to say, what you don't believe that Britannia rules the waves, that Britain is a very great dynamic business country. I mean, look at the news, September the 16th, was it? Look at the newspaper, pound goes into free fall, beaten Lamont devalues the pound, Britain is finished, so you can't really believe all this stuff about Britain being Tarshish, can you? Friends and sisters, let us remember the words of Cyril Tennant and Brother Thomas, don't let us generate our views on the last day by the newspapers. Because look, that's 1992. 2 years ago, the pound soared as Britain joined the ERM. Strong exports will save the UK economy from a... What are you talking about 2 years ago? And if you want something from a year ago, the London Evening said, Standard said we'd have the best trade figures for years. Do you see how dangerous it is to sit down and say, because Russia has, or USSR is finished, because Britain no longer was what it was in the 19th century, therefore we must throw away the views and the beliefs we once had about Britain in prophecy. The exhortation, if you don't mind me taking some words from Paul to the Corinthians, when it comes to prophecy, brothers and sisters, let us walk by faith and not by sight. Let us do what we as a body did in the 1850s, 60s, 70s, 80s, to 100 years ago, and say no matter what the media may be telling us about the state of world politics in the Middle East, we believe the time is coming when Christ will return to that kingdom, and when, indeed, there would be that time of Armageddon. Now, that's not our intention tonight to go into the details of Armageddon, but you know roughly what we say. Turn to Ezekiel 38, if you will. How these nations of Tagama, Rosh, Meshech, Tubal, Gomer, and Magog, they're all spelled out there, brothers and sisters, in Ezekiel 38. And there hasn't until recently been any great debate about those nations. You see, Ezekiel 38, we quickly identify these nations as being out of the north, Meshech, Tubal, here they are. Persia, Ethiopia, and Libya, no doubt about those, they're all equally spelled out. Gomer, verse 6. The house of Tagama of the north quarters, and all his bands, and many, many people with them. And so when we just say, well, Russia will come down into Israel, I think we ought to be a little more careful now, because my question to you would be, well, which Russia? Of course it could. I mean, Russia's waiting a new go, isn't it? Russia is in a situation where even Yeltsin more or less admitted when he came to see John Major this week, while I'm away, who knows, there might be a takeover by a reactionary force, and there might yet be another Gove emerge. But be that as it may, this party is to come down out of the north, many peoples, a great confederacy out of Europe, to take a spoil and a prey. And then we come to verse 13. Sheba and Dedan and the merchants of Tarshish with all the young lions thereof. And of course, people say, ah, well, you know, those were the recruiting posters of the First World War. Brothers and sisters, that's not so. It started. It started a lot earlier in the 1890s. My father was, his grandfather was one stage editor of Glad Tidings, and when he died in 1947, he bequeathed to me his scrapbook. In a way, it's pathetic, you know, to see the little bits of paper that he cut out of the Daily Mail from 1899. And December 1899, because little news items showed to him the hand of God at work in the nations of men. But also coming from 1899 is that cartoon showing Britain long before conscription was ever thought about. And so it was convenient to talk about Britain with the young lions thereof, or the family of lions, when talking about the British Commonwealth. Of course, we've all seen these sort of pictures, the empire leads men. But where did they get that kind of idea from? Well, of course, the lion was very much on the imperial standard of Great Britain, as you see. But you know, you've seen those sort of things. Other pictures, there's one of a recruiting poster, or a cartoon, or a picture of the First World War, how the nations of Canada, Australia, New Zealand, and Africa responded to the call. See what I mean about ethnic? The white English-speaking peoples. Could be, that's what it will be. And so we see then that those lions are responding to the call of the old lion. Now, one of the saddest attempts to destroy our belief in the views of our community on Tarshish is to turn around and say, get away. You look at the RSV. Anyone got an RSV? Is there an RSV in the house? Well, that's interesting. Yeah, it's got one up the back there. Dare I say, anyone got an NIV in the house? There is one. Or two. No, I think you know what I think of the NIV. Good News Bible? Well, let's have a look and see what that verse, how it comes out. You see, because that idea of lions is an old imperialist idea. You know, this is all sort of Victorian grandiose imperialism. Well, in the Authorised Version, we read how Sheba and Dedan and the merchants of Tarshish with all the young lions shall say, what have you come for? Now, in the NIV, and I think also in the RSV, check me if I'm wrong, please, you have Sheba and Dedan, the merchants of Tarshish, and all her villages. Gone is the word lions. And they say, have you come to plunder? Good News Bible, people of Sheba and Dedan, and the merchants from the towns of Spain. Oh dear, they're way off course, aren't they? I mean, unless, of course, despite everything you've seen, you still believe that Tarshish is Spain. But you see where certain of these versions can throw you off course unless you consider all the evidence. They say, have you assembled your army? But the towns of Spain, the villages of Tarshish, show undoubtedly, without any shadow of a doubt, there's one article here, that this idea of Britain and the lions is quite old-fashioned, it's old hat, and not worthy of us today. Is that so? I must say, when you get the RSV, NIV, GMB, and I don't know about the New King James Version, all coming up with the same translation, it does prompt you to check the facts. Go back and see what the basis is for this argument. Well, it's very interesting. You turn up the concordance, and you discover that there are six different words for lion. Now, I know no Hebrew and no Greek. Perhaps, in some ways, that's an advantage if one is blessed with a modicum of common sense, too. You notice that there are two words for a lion. That's the lions that would be involved with Babylon when you hear about the lions there. There's an Ari and a Libay. There's a roaring, fierce old lion, which is a Hebrew word, a Lavi and a Shekal. There's an old lion, which is a Laish. But what about this young lion bit of Ezekiel 38? Well, you discover that the word young lion, the original word, is a kefar. I think that's how you, young and others spell it differently, but I think it's pronounced kefar. Alright, so when you read about young lions, you read about that Hebrew word kefar. So you find out, trace it through to yourself. Anybody can do this. Remember, the idea that Britain is a mother lion and has all these associated powers is now under threat because you've got the wrong word, brethren, says it should be villages. Well, is it? Well, when you look at the word kefar, you discover that 29 times it's translated as a young lion or a whelp. And that's not a baby lion. It's a lion that's grown up and grown strong and left the fold. However, on one occasion, it is, on one time, translated as villages. And that's in Nehemiah. Don't bother to turn to it. It's an occasion where Sanballat was going up and down the land visiting the villages. What do you think? That's a bit strange. one out of 29 times, it has the translation of villages in Nehemiah, and it doesn't seem to offer any help at all. So you look up the word villages, and you discover that the word villages in Young's Concordance is an English word that occurs 65 times. But it takes 9 Hebrew words to do that. All right, you look down the Hebrew words for villages, and you discover, lo and behold, only once. And in Nehemiah chapter 6, Sanballat going throughout the land, going to the villages, does it use kafar? Now, I think anyone with average common sense says, well, that's a bit funny. I know no Hebrew, so I'll get out the Strong's Concordance. And I'm trying to be as fair as I can to those who in all seriousness have challenged what we believe, saying, it's villages, lad, it's not lions. And so, you look up the Hebrew. Now, I don't know whether you can see this in fact, but you see those of the squiggles up there with 2 T's underneath it. Forgive me, with the Hebrew-speaking brethren, forgive me as a layman, I have to look at this with common sense, not with Hebrew knowledge. And I discover that that Hebrew word is a village. But, please note, Strong's Concordance says, in the case of Nehemiah chapter 6, verse 2, it is that with 3 dots under it, and not 2 dots under it. Which is a little amazing, because anyone with average eyesight can see that that is virtually the same as that. And which is a young lion, already weaned, and having begun to rave and so on. So, do you realise that our traditional view of the role of Tarshish in the last days depends on one word out of 94 verses, the verses relating to villages, the verses relating to life? Some experts say, well, that was a copyist error. Well, maybe. But does one word, brothers and sisters, out of 94 verses constitute a sound basis for rejecting our trad views? Other experts have pointed out that by adding one jot to that Hebrew word, you know what a jot is? A jot is the, if I remember rightly, the smallest letter in the Hebrew alphabet. You find it in Psalm 119, give or take some verse 70, something like that. That you add just one jot, and you change the meaning from villages to lions. So you have to ask yourself, is that a sound reason for overturning the faith of so many in the role of Britain in the last days? I have to say I don't think so. Oh, and by the way, if you look in today's paper, you will see this big argument in the Telegraph about the new European fighter bomber. Do you know what the Israelis have called their new fighter bomber? Would they, I ask myself, have called their new combat fighter villages? They called it the kafar. Lion. So you see how slender is the basis that is used to assail those things which many of us have always believed. Tarshish, where is it? Tartessus, metal, Spain? That's the one attached to it. The authority of the sources, Smith's Bible Dictionary doesn't support that view, Encyclopedia Britannica doesn't, all those secular authorities don't. But you have to have a bit of sense of humour, I suppose. Supposing if they were right, and supposing the villages of Tarshish were the traders, the people in the east who did business with Tarshish, I just ask myself whether those could possibly be the villages of Tarshish. Dathan, Bahrain, Qatar, Doha, Abu Dhabi, Dubai, Sharjah, plus Sheba and Dedan. Do we have to press this further? I don't know if you've seen Brother Paul Billington's book on Guardians of Israel, a most excellent book. It really tells you a lot more about it. But I ask you, brothers and sisters, to consider seriously whether that is a sound objection, because it rests on one word out of 95 verses. All right, let's turn to a different subject completely. Cyprus. Do you remember I said you could, of course, always take some zinc, you could take some copper, and I'm told if you mix them in the right proportions, you end up with brass, the brazen-coated grease. We reminded ourselves that Kittim was the brother of Tarshish. Now I want to take you to a verse that I've had great problems with, and I want your help to understand it. Would you turn to Numbers 24? Because here is Balaam's prophecy, and it's a verse which, again, if you... I don't know if you've got one of those computerized index things that tell you where to go and look up explanations of verses, but I've only got the index. I know nothing about computers, but it's quite helpful. If you come to Numbers 24, what do you read under verse 23 and 24? You read some verses which one or two of our brethren have had great difficulty with. He took up this parable and said, "Alas, who shall live when God doeth this? The ship shall come to the coast of Chittim, and shall afflict Asher, and shall afflict Eber, and so he will perish forever." Well, what does that mean? What does that mean? Turn to NIV, and you have a clue. Balaam uttered this prophecy. Who are these people gathering in the north? So this is a totally different approach. But it does say, verse 24, helpfully, invaders will sail from Cyprus, they will conquer Assyria and Eber, but they in turn will perish forever. Are we any further down the road looking at the NIV? The reason why, by the way, they talk about people gathering in the north is because I'm told that the Masoretic text says something about the people in the left. The left is the north, because you face the sun this way, and up there on your left is the north, and that's why that text occurs, so I'm told by one brother who knows a little Hebrew. However, I was told by another brother who knows a lot more Hebrew to see the whole issue in its context. Turn, if you would, to verse 14. Now what do you find? You find in verse 14 of Numbers 24 that Balaam is talking about the latter days. And I've just put on the screen the key verses. So here's a prophecy then about the latter days, as I see it. He comes to verse 20 and he says, and he looked on Amalek and he took up this parable and said, Amalek was the first of the nations, but his latter end shall be that he shall perish forever. And of course you go to Samuel and you know what happened to the Amalekites. Saul said unto Samuel, "Yea, I have obeyed the voice of the Lord, and have gone the way which the Lord sent me, and have brought Agag, king of Amalek, and have utterly destroyed the Amalekites." Well, I mean, how does this prophecy then, if the Amalekites were destroyed, how does this prophecy have anything to do with the latter days? Good question. Verse 23. So he takes up this parable. What parable? Well, the one of the latter days. And says, "Alas, who shall live when God doeth this?" Second rule of simple Bible exposition, when you see the word, well, I've been taught anyways, when you see the word God, in whatever form it is, stop and take it very seriously. Don't just wash it out of the window with a modern translation. So, who shall live when God doeth this? The ships will come from the coast of Cyprus and shall attack Asher and Eber. All right? Now, what does that verse mean? Well, I'm told by another brother, who also speaks a lot of Hebrew, that the correct translation for verse 23 is, "Who shall live when El, God, appoints him?" Who? Appoints who? Well, verse 20 puts the context, appoints Amalek. So, who shall live when the time comes when the Lord will appoint Amalek? Who is Amalek? Type of Russia. Septuagint puts in not Agag, king of the Amalekites, but Gog. I think we readily will accept that. So verse 24 now reads, "Ships or troops shall come from the side of Kittim, i.e. the brother of Tarshish, and they will fight Asher and Eber." Don't worry about the word coast, by the way. Don't let us think in terms of coast, meaning Llandudno, Colwyn Bay, or Bognor Regis, because Edom had coasts. And that was the biggest beach without a sea anywhere in the Middle East, wasn't it? So coast means, like Warwickshire, Staffordshire, have coasts. It means from the side. All right, now how does that help us? We have a problem. Of course you could say, well, that's interesting enough, but what is Asher and Eber? Herein lies my problem. You pursue this again with a concordance and you say, well, shall we just say that Asher equals Syria?
or is it Russia?
And shall we just say that Eva equals the Jews, so that when the time comes and God says, who's going to live when that power comes down out of the north and destroys Syria and the Jews? Well, one learns again that Eva, Hebrew, Abraham was a Hebrew, Genesis 15 is it, and the Septuagint describes Abraham as being a man from the yonder region. Although as expert in the pointing of the details of Hebrew language, it pointed out to me, it's a question of whether there were three dots or two dots under one letter. Forgive me being an amateur, but you know, there's a very wise article, wasn't there, in the Christadelphian last month about this subject, and equally wise one by Bernard Burton, the Bible student magazine I've just seen. I know no Hebrew, but I can get a magnifying glass and look. And Abraham becomes one who crossed over the river. Well, that's right. He was called out, wasn't he? So if you say that Abraham was a Hebrew, well, yes, he was. Because Eber was a land east of the Euphrates. Turn back to Genesis 10 and lo and behold, what do you find? Eber did in fact beget Peleg, who beget Abraham, who beget the Jews. But Eber also, at the time the world was divided, therein lies an interesting point, beget Joktan. Who was Joktan? Well, most, I think, Christadelphians would say they're Arabs, possibly in Saudi Arabia, but certainly east of the river. So, where's that got us? And what's this got to do with our subject? Well, let's ask a simple question, brothers and sisters. When the Northern Confederacy moves southwards, when God says, who shall live when he, the Northern power, comes down into Cyprus, who shall he meet? What will he be waiting for? Well, I'll give you a couple of clues. Kittim, remember, was the brother of Tarshish. Tarshish said thank you very much to the Sultan of the Ottoman Empire as a token of our help in keeping Russia out of the Middle East until God's time came for it to happen, we'll have Cyprus. And so Britain inherited Cyprus. Now, what will happen when the power out of the north comes down to the land of Kittim? There they will encounter an island which is divided. The Turkish part in the north, and in the south, the Greek part. And then, as Disraeli worked out, in view of his perception of what the Bible was teaching in the last days, there, when you get to Cyprus, you will find Akrotirion Deucalion. Well, it's exquisitely interesting, but they are British sovereign territories. And if you saw that article on the military situation in Bosnia, it was in the Telegraph, they are the largest overseas bases, apart from Germany, certainly the overseas air force bases of Tarshish in the Middle East. So when the power comes down out of the north, lo and behold, it will come to Akrotiri and Deucalion, and there it will encounter sovereign territory of Tarshish. By the way, if you go to Larnaca Airport, they take you around the corner to the tourist site called Kittim. There's no doubt about that. But if you then go on a tourist trip up into the mountains, what do you find? The world's strongest and most powerful listening stations, tuned in towards the power in the north. So when we look at the Middle East and we see a map with which we are familiar, we see Cyprus over here, Britain retaining those places, sovereign territory. They're not just army camps, they're British territory. When, therefore, the power out of the north comes down to the coast of Cyprus, does Spain have in mind a situation where it then proceeds to the destruction of Syria and to Eber east of the river? I put this very tentatively because it does fit, doesn't it, with what we expect Russia to do when it achieves its old people of great ambitions to get back to whence it came, Istanbul, and onwards to Cyprus. And from there, will destroy Syria and Eber. Assisted, of course, by Persia, who joins in, but there will encounter Tarshish. I don't know. I don't know how else one can understand those verses, but if we see it in the context of the latter days, can we expect, therefore, one of the first encounters with Tarshish to be right there in the island that we were given for helping to keep Russia out of the Middle East 100 years ago? Well, if Britain is Tarshish, what are the implications? Well, we have to be Gulf-oriented. We have to be down there in the Gulf where we were a little while ago. We have to have suitable allies. We have to be strong enough to oppose. I've changed it, I think, advisedly to challenge, because I have to admit that the text does read more in the nature of a challenge than a war, doesn't it? Against this northern confederacy. Somehow or other, and supplying arms to Iraq doesn't help, somehow or other we have to be in favour with the Jews and some Arabs. Christadelphian expectation for 145 years. Somehow or other, and I know not how, and after listening to that debate in the synod this week, the church is about as far as it could get from the word of God, but somehow or other, we have to come and accept Christ as a people. Why? It doesn't look possible at the moment, but we walk by faith and not by sight. And we have to remember that a lot will happen in those last days. It could just be, couldn't it, that if we're going to have a terrible winter, is this the start of the humbling of Tarshish, the economic power, the terrible times that lie ahead? But meanwhile, however, if we're going to be there, we have to become independent of, this is a mouthful, the Latino-Greek-Russian Confederacy, alias Papal Europe. Where do we get that idea from? Let's remind ourselves of Neb's image, brothers and sisters. Let's remind ourselves it's not preserved so that we might give lectures on ancient history on Sunday nights, but rather that we may share with our friends what is to happen in the latter days. The whole purpose of going to Daniel 2 on a Sunday night is to end up at verse 44 saying, "The days of these kings shall the God of heaven set up a kingdom which will never be destroyed." And at that moment, it's 7:20 and the meeting ends. And that's the very moment that our friends are interested in. That's what they came for. They didn't come for a lecture in Assyrian history, Babylonian history, Medo-Persian, all exquisitely interesting, yes, but I want to know, in the days of which king shall the God of heaven set up a kingdom which shall be destroyed, never be destroyed? Well, it's the days of these 10-toed kingdoms. And to cut a long story short, we have to say to folks, we'll come back next week and we'll actually deal with the subject of these kings, the successors to the two legs of the old Roman Empire. Well, it's quite sensible if Neb's image, whom we've given a couple of hip operations to make it stand like that, if the two legs were the leg of Rome and the leg of Constantinople, whatever happened in 1453 when Islam came, just like Revelation 9 said it would, and drove the, quote, Christians northwards? Well, the last empire did the wise thing of marrying the archbishop's daughter, took her with her up to Moscow, and you are seeing today before your very eyes the resurgence of the Eastern Catholic Church, the Eastern Orthodox Church. And so we are saying to our friends, look, it's in the days of these kings. It's not in the days of Babylon, not in the days of Medo-Persia that Christ will return, nor in the days of Greece, nor in the days of the two legs of the Roman Empire. But we have to face up to it. What then? Well, it's in the days of the successors to the old Roman Empire, for they shall mingle themselves. And 140 years ago, just as the Crimean War was ending, our forebears devised a mouthful of a title called The Time of the End, when they shall mingle themselves, and we could look for a Latin, Greek, Byzantine, was Greek village, Russian confederacy. In fact, a book was written on that subject, and it was subtitled in 1854 that this Bible student looked forward to the time of a Russian Latino-Greek confederacy. Well, what sort of stupid man would do a thing like that when the Crimean War has just been won by Britain, when Balaclava and the Charge of the Light Brigade and the Lady with the Lamp and Florence Nightingale and all that bit? What sort of person would actually dare to publish a book that said the time is coming when Russia will in fact go into the Middle East. Well, brothers and sisters, it could only be one who believed in Bible prophecy. And so Anatolia was the title of the book, and it's still available today, but don't go round to the office and ask for it, or if you do, ask for it under its present title of The Exposition of Daniel. So we're looking for a time when there will be a great confederacy in Europe. This is standard stuff, isn't it? Tubal, Rosh, Tagama, Meshech. When it gets to identifying those nations, we all know the bit about Meshech equals Muscovy, Rosh equals Russia, Tubal, Tobolsky, and then you come to Gomer and Magog. Who are they?
Well, I think for the most part, in fact, I think I've told you this before, I went along to my local library, and they do think I'm a pain there, and I said, look, I'm doing a research project for my church, you know, and I want to find out what you think is Gomer and Magog. And the lady said, who? I said, Gomer and Magog, you know, it's in the Bible, I spelled it out. Well, after a little while, they did this sort of research, and they said, well, look, the best we can come back with is this. And that basically was the outline of the, if you like, the findings of Bromley Library as to who Gomer and Magog were. The outlines of the Holy Roman Empire. The outlines of Charlemagne's empire. And don't you think it's fascinatingly interesting that Maastricht may yet bring John Major down? So, if that looks something like a united Europe, brothers and sisters, have you ever realised that it was at Aachen that Charlemagne made his headquarters of the Empire of Charlemagne? It was just across the river from what is now Maastricht. It was at Aachen that King Otto, seeing that the empire was falling apart, stood up, and the people said to King Otto, the founder or the first king of the Holy Roman Empire, they raised their right hands and stood to attention and saluted him, and they cried, "Victory and salvation," which in German is Sieg Heil. Maybe you've seen it before. Interesting. And don't you think it's interesting, if you've ever been to Holland with all those beautiful tulip bulb fields, those wonderful towns of Amsterdam and Rotterdam and The Hague and Volendam with all the windmills, why should Holland have chosen Maastricht or Aachen to celebrate the possible uniting of Europe? Well, it's not really our subject, it's all incidental to what we're talking about. If we can't see it, brothers and sisters, Time magazine can. I don't know how many of you saw that that little picture from Time magazine last winter. But what is it? It's Revelation chapter 17, isn't it? It's a woman riding upon a beast. Now, if we can't see it, Time magazine can. With amazing accuracy, look carefully at the flags of those people. She is carrying the banner of a united Europe. And where, brothers and sisters, do you see the Union Jack? Incredible. What marvellous act. I don't suppose they realised what they were doing. But if you wanted a visual presentation of what our subject is in part at this moment, it's there. Of course, we know that lady somewhat better. We know how she has been fighting to get out of Europe. Chinese say that one picture says 10,000 words. Do you remember those cartoons of Guy the Seer like swinging a handbag as she goes across continental hypocrisy? And stands there on the white cliffs of Dover, throwing her cannonballs at a united Europe. And so, do we believe in Maggie Thatcher? The decisions of statesmen are devoid of stability, are they not? And when we looked at this a couple of years ago, we tried to make it absolutely clear that we're not bothered about what happens to Mrs. Thatcher. So do we now change our views then, because Maggie Thatcher resigned? Are we going to allow the media to influence our belief in what must happen? No. Do you mind if I just remind you that 20 years ago, James Callaghan, the socialist leader, had exactly the same problem. Change your ways or else. James Callaghan yesterday demanded sweeping changes in the common market if Britain is to remain a member of the community. Doesn't change, does it? Men may come, men may go. And Britain does not want to bank on Europe, says John Major. So we're not allowing what happens in the kingdom of men to influence our belief in and understanding of the word of God, but rather are we as watchers with the word of prophecy. Now, when I arrived here, I saw on the notice board outside a cutting from today's Daily Telegraph. Anyone see the Telegraph today? Not a Telegraph reader in the house. Oh, where does that leave me? Well, come on, John. There is one. So, in that case, forgive me, it's the end of an evening. But this morning's Daily Telegraph. No cry for Rory the Lion. Britain's difficulties in Europe appear to have no end last night when it was confirmed that Rory, the President's promised Lion Cup mascot, died in August. And that was the lion that was going to be presented at the Edinburgh Conference when Britain was running for the presidency. When Rory the Lion, the logo of the presidency and a strong Britain in Europe, was unveiled in April by Mr. Hurd, hopes were high. Events have conspired against Mr. Major and Mr. Hurd, the deepening Maastricht crisis, the forced exit of the pound from the exchange rate mechanism, and a rising tide of hostility in Brussels to the British. And no, like, I don't take any notice of that, but it is interesting how people in the world can see the situation we are in. That we have no part in a papal-dominated Europe. And so then we have to say to ourselves, if Britain is Tarshish, or if it is part of a latter-day confederacy, stop and think about this. What are we seeing? We're seeing the GATT trade talks fall apart. We're seeing America distance itself from Europe. Who is Britain going to back if it comes to the crunch? Let us not speculate. We're not here to predict what will happen. I don't know what will happen. But I could see a situation whereby the English, ethnic, English-speaking, Western powers find themselves at odds with Europe. And surely, therefore, we have to say, when you consider what is in store, we can't really see long-term Britain being allied to Europe. So then, no matter what may happen at forthcoming conferences, in the end, and at the end, Britain will have no part in the European Confederacy. Why? Because we don't like Frenchmen? No. Because God has marked out a pattern, if I may just read, and doesn't it apply today? Why won't we be? Because the finger of God has indicated a course of action to be pursued by Britain which cannot be evaded, and which her counsellors will not only be willing but eager to adopt when the crisis comes upon them. Don't you think, brothers and sisters, we're getting very close to that crisis? Britain has no part in the beast system of Europe because God has ordained it has other things to do. So then, when we come in the spirit of Ned's image and we see this emerging alliance between the East and the West, express it in whatever terms you like, between the clay and the iron, and when we see the hammer and the sickle of communism disappearing, and the two-headed eagle of Byzantium, the two-headed eagle that you find in the Austro-Hungarian Empire, and yea, verily, in Moscow itself, when we see that hammer and sickle giving way to the re-emergence of those great symbols of the old empires, envy, brothers and sisters, no Britain.